You're listening to The Deceptionists. On this episode, Dave, Caroline, Jim, and Kelly dig deeper into world building with giraffe necks, sentient DVRs, vampires coming out, and something about a squid.
What's he building in there? What the hell is he building in there? He has subscriptions to those magazines. He never waves when he goes by. He's hiding something from the rest of us. He's all to himself. I think I know why.
You are listening to The Deceptionist, Truth Through Fiction, a monthly podcast dedicated to the art of stories and storytelling. We attempt to bring a sense of community to the solitary life of the writer. I am Caroline Pruitt. With me this week is David Campo.
Hey.
Kelly Stevenson.
Hello.
And Jim Rutschkowski. I'm sorry.
Hi there. No one will judge you.
I swear I've done it correctly before. Maybe, maybe not. All right. Well, this is our regular panel at The Deceptionist, and this is the second show in our series on world building. And last month, we talked about the idea of building worlds in science fiction, fantasy, historical fiction, basically building worlds that are not exactly like our own. We talked about that last time in terms of why we do it, what sort of the basic meaning of world building is, and what we are attempting to do now is get down a little bit more of the nitty-gritty in terms of if you're actually doing this, if you're the person who's sitting down making up a fictional world to write about it, what are the steps? What kind of things do you need in order to say that you've actually done your world-building homework, perhaps before you start? And I just wanted to kind of go around the table and see what initial thoughts everybody has about this. I will say that the reason I'm interested in this series is I'm really bad at this. I don't really usually know enough right about what I'm doing when I started. So I would like to hear some thoughts that other people have besides me. So Dave, do you want to start out?
Sure. You can just put me on the spot like that.
thank you, Dave.
No. Last time, we really talked a lot about why, and that was really fascinating to me because I feel like it's something that we've all done, and as I look around, I realize just how often we build worlds in fiction, how often we don't go for straight realism. And I think something that we touched on even last time is that we do realize that even in realist fiction, there's world building whenever you write a story. I mean, take any series on TV, Downton Abbey, that is a world. You can't tell me that's not a world. Yes, it's based on a historical, time period, and they're trying to be accurate to that time period, but they're still, in a sense, building a world. But, what was fascinating to me in the last conversation is, why go beyond just pure reality? Why strip that away and use, just all the facets of our imagination to be able to take stories in completely different directions and just use those extra tools to get at the truth? I really liked what Kelly said last time about, if you're going to take, I'm sorry to do this, a vampire story.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I know. I'm leading with it already.
I'm cackling on mute.
But the idea that we don't know what it's like to be immortal, but we can use our imagination and we conjure up, we will now have an immortal character. What are the things he's going to go through? And so project, that. So in terms of, we're trying to talk about how we start, right? What I would say is this, I don't think I'm being terribly original. I'll use Wormwood as an example of one that, I mention a lot on here, but that's one where, it was definitely a built world. And part of it for me was building the world of the characters and their interactions and their relationships. But then there was the, what are the strange things? How is this world different than ours? And it was a urban fantasy, I guess, is the closest sort of marketing definition, which is, we were joking about this in our emails earlier. It's like our world with flair. and I think I kind of, in that sense, went with, sort of the, what I think a lot of longer running series do, I'm going to just, use Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which is like, well, everything supernatural is real, but now we're just going to kind of suss out our rules. Like, these are our rules for vampires. These are our rules for werewolves, for demons, for, this is how it all works. And, for me, what's interesting, and I'll be really curious to hear what you guys think, is that I have a hard time just going like, I'm going to make the rules. I actually have to have a character go in somewhere and then I have to be like, man, I need some rules. And then I kind of figure it out and I draw the connections. And that I know that in this show before, that seems very antithetical to what Kelly does, but I kind of have this weird feeling that we're not that different in that I maybe have to write a paragraph before I have to do it. Kelly maybe internalizes the paragraph and says, like, I need something to do, with this character, but I need to know where he came from. Oh, well, I need to know the history of, this fantastic land. And then, starts coming up with all this stuff where I may be like, well, I need him to say something to somebody at the bar. What's he going to say? Well, what's his accent like? Where's he from? Oh, okay. And then we kind of do the same. And I kind of end up doing a lot of the same thing.
Well, you're not even that different from the examples you mentioned, because in the case of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the rules sort of change as the years go on. Like, at first, they say about vampires, if a vampire version of your friend comes after you, don't worry, you're not killing him, you're killing the thing that killed him. The idea being that demons are mindless, fair game. But then by the end of the series, they were saying that there were good demons and bad demons, and there was that guy Clem, who you maybe don't kill, and some of them are friendly. And I remember being really offended by that at the time, because it's like, well, then you can't stake anybody without like a job interview.
You have to have a trial.
Yeah.
Well, and trial if they go back and get their soul, spoiler.
Right.
That defeats that purpose, too. Like, you could have saved your friend by making him go get a soul.
Go ahead.
Because I want to sort of set aside the issue of, like, stuff changing over time. Because I think it's a good point that it does. But I think that once we've said that, I think we do want to kind of talk about what you start with as a baseline. But I think what both of you are saying is interesting, because what I had just jotted down when Dave said rules is, why are rules, which is bad grammar, but sounds like a cat macro. But what I have is, think about, maybe to think about, what is the purpose of putting the rules in there? Are they there because they improve the story? Are they there because you're kind of talking about these rules help to set up the moral universe. And so you're really creating trouble for yourself if you're going to completely change that universe because, Buffy's a serial killer now because she's killing all these people who are actually redeemable. Surprise. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I think...
No, yeah, you go ahead because I forgot what I was going to say.
Okay, sorry.
I think just to Dave's point about... which end do you start with? Do you start with the characters or do you start with the rules? I think it really depends on that first why you're writing it. Because I know that we talked in the last podcast that there's really two things that kind of drive it. It's you want to either explore a certain type of character or you want to answer kind of a what if question. What if we were living side by side with, let's go with vampires for the last 5 centuries, or what if what was the one you used, Carolyn, about like a sovereign nation in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean?
Yes.
I think if you start with those, like, what would it look like if, that's when you start with the rules, or you start with history, or you start with something other than let me create a cool character and see what her world looks like from there. Because I know that when I got fed up with crappy vampire book at one point, I kind of noticed that there's a lot of fiction out there that was vampires are secret, and so there were stories where somebody found out about the vampires that have been living there with us, and then there was this sort of new thing where it was like everyone has known about vampires have always been around, and there's the True Blood and the Sookie Stackhouse, and even things like the comic that just came out a couple of months ago, the new Deadwardian.
Oh, yes.
About vampires and zombies living in Victorian England. And so there was all of this, like, vampires are secret stories, and there was all of these vampires came out before my story begins, and now we're just exploring what that world looks like. I wanted to write something that was, what does it look like when they come out? So at that point, I really had to go back and figure out, okay, why would they come out? How would they come out? How would it be successful? And it wasn't until I sort of had their history and the highlights of what they would do, the process of coming out and what that would look like, that once I started doing that, then I started finding the characters and the plot within that.
Yeah, and that kind of puts into what I said about why are the rules. The rule in that case is, previously, they were secret. Vampires were secret. Well, what changed? What is, so you have to kind of look at the, and what changed to make them want to go public would have to have something to do with what was the reason for the role in the first place. I really love the first Iron Man movie ends with Tony Stark basically saying, I am Iron Man, you know, to everybody. And they do not go through like 40 years of him pretending to have a secret identity.
Right.
Because that's, if you read like Iron Man comics from several decades, they are bending over backwards to try and right away in which it makes sense that this guy who is like a, you know, billionaire narcissist who can afford his own police force. Like, you know, like I understand why Spider-Man doesn't want people to know his identity because somebody's going to go try to murder his sick aunt. But there's really no actual good reason that you know, you can plausibly say that for a character like Iron Man the way he was established in the movie. So I appreciate that they're like, we're not going to do this just because every superhero movie ever has always had the guy had a secret identity. And so that sort of is the same issue with Kelly. If vampires were real, maybe everybody would know about them. You know, like mm-hmm. When we have vampires are secret and, you know, Bella or Buffy or whoever stumbles on the secret vampire culture, is that just there so you can tell this story about secrecy? And if you don't want that to be your story, don't use that rule or break that rule. So mm-hmm. so that would be an interesting way to go into it.
You know, it's interesting when you say that because I will lose my train of thought and then ramble for a minute. No, I was thinking something and I just completely lost it. But, you know, when you talk about the rules, I may be straying away from what we're supposed to be talking about slightly, but, you know, one of the things that rules when you talk about vampires or this or that setup is consequences. Mm-hmm. And another aspect of that I always think of is one of the trickiest things when you're thinking about how to write magic characters, and I know we've talked about this before, is that it's too easy to just have them go abracadabra and then the thing that they want to go away goes away. Mm-hmm. And so I've been thinking about that a lot because I've been thinking that, you know, if you're going to use magic, a world with magic in it, then you need to set up that world in a way that magic has consequences that it's not easy to use, you know, because I think then you're running a theme. And I've been thinking about this with something that I'm sort of developing on this side and I haven't really dealt with it yet, but, you know, the idea would be, you know, you might have to use it, but it's not going to make your life better. I mean, that's the thing about going back to your Spider-Man example. It's like he has these great powers. It doesn't make his life better. And they actually have done a great job over the years of finding ways to make having these powers actually makes his life more miserable. This responsibility, this constant fear, these enemies coming after him because of who he is, you know, all this kind of stuff.
I was thinking about that when we were talking about magic on the last show, or I was thinking about when I was listening to the last show. I mean, one of the things you can say about magic comes to us in a lot of ways through folk tales and fairy tales, and those are always set up in a way that there are some kind of rules to the magic, and it's somebody telling you have three wishes.
Right.
And, well, why are there three wishes? Well, on one level, there's three wishes because there's a story. You know, there has to be some limitation because we used to always play when we were kids that we found a genie and then we would ask the genie to grant us the wish that we could have every wish we wanted for the rest of our lives.
Right.
And so then like the rest of the game would just be, what is everything that you want? Let's pretend that it's happening.
Right.
Which is incredibly fun when you're five. I don't know.
It was fun last week. I don't know what you're talking about. No.
Well, yes, that would all. Go ahead.
Yeah.
I think what we're doing right now actually is the difference between good fiction and mediocre fiction. Mm-hmm. If you strip away all the consequences, then you just have quite literally a 5-year-old's fantasy. And that's just not interesting to a lot of people because there's no consequences.
Yeah, yeah.
And I do want to back up in a second. We've been using the word rule, but I think what I'm using it as is literally just the framework of the world.
Okay.
So mm-hmm. it's the history. It's the if there is some sort of technology or magical element to the world, it is the way that that works. If it's a magical creature, it's the things about that creature that make it, but it's just the general framework of the world that makes it what it is.
And yeah, and I was thinking about that in terms of if you're trying to build that, one thing that might be good is to go back and look at who created that framework, who handed down that framework. And like, I think actually going back to Buffy, I agree that like the whole thing where they kept changing demons and souls, a lot of that was kind of lame. But I think one of the things that they did well, at least over some of the shows, was that they sort of examined the whole Slayer mythology and where that came from. Well, it came from the Watchers Council. Well, where did the Watchers Council get it from? Who tells them that they get to make these particular rules? Mm-hmm. And even though I'm not going to cite something that was a wonderful movie, but I did see Snow White and the Huntsman a couple weeks ago, and that is basically
wonderful movie.
It was a version of the Snow White story, and it's the very very familiar the Wicked Queen who doesn't want Snow White to be as beautiful as she is sort of story, and it turns out as you go through the movie that this is because whatever kind of magic was given to her by her mother has very specific conditions on it. And that is that she can only be defeated by somebody, or she can only keep her power as long as she is the most beautiful woman. And her power will completely evaporate if she can't hold on to this. So for that character, there's a motivation for that. And then I thought, well, why? I think the more interesting story of that actually is, well, why would the mother do that? If you wanted to, she's actually doing something that you want to help your child. Why would you give her this power that only has this particular condition? And so I'm like, well, if I was making up that story, like that's probably what was given her by her mother. And so there, if you have to go back far enough to the source of the power, somebody has just, whoever is behind making those rules, perhaps has an agenda that they don't, that they maybe want to cause conflict, that they don't want these people gain a certain amount of power, so they have put limits on it. So I think that that's sort of a way to look at it for mm-hmm. something like magic. Like, yeah, well, yes, theoretically, this could be infinitely powerful. So go back to the source. Where would the limits come from? And so that might be a way to do that, is sort of look at that.
So you're really good at world building, Caroline.
Well, I'm
you're trying to explain away to it, like. I mean, you say you're not used to it and you're not familiar with it. I think you might be a lot more familiar with it than you think you are.
Well, let me put this. What I'm talking about is essentially fan fiction. And I don't mean that even just like literally in the. I mean, I'm looking at something that somebody else came up with and trying to jigger out the rules for that. So I guess that's kind of something that I'm used to doing and that I'm kind of interested in. But go ahead.
No, I was just saying in a broader sense, and I'm going to dial it back here slightly, please, but whenever please. We talk about like worlds of fantasy mm-hmm. and we're building a world, I mean, look at my example. I said, well, I just kind of took the Buffy the Vampire Slayer mm-hmm. tactic, and I said, well, you know, and this is specifically how Wyrmwood started, is I said, well, I want to have a guy, and like he's a cult detective. Why is he an occult detective? Well, it's because he was like this really awesome psychologist, and he thought he had everyone figured out and knew how everyone worked, and then like he met basically Reagan from The Exorcist, and it just blew his whole world apart. And I said, what does that do to a guy? And I said, that's uh-huh. our guy. He's now, okay. And now he like studies the occult because he's trying to understand it because it's the thing he doesn't understand. And so, but still what I'm doing is I picked something that already exists in folklore, in superstition, in mythology. I went and said, I am going to use something that the culture already knows about, you know, demons and possession, and I'm going to start there. I think Buffy does the same thing in almost all those shows. If you start with vampires, you're not making up a vampire for the first time. You weren't in isolation. You said, there's something intriguing about that idea. I want to use it to tell a story. And so to me, all of those stuff, if we dial it back to just that larger world of fantasy, is that there is this part of our culture. There is folklore, mythology, superstition, stuff that is, you know, just collectively passed along through human civilization that, you know, we just sort of have at our hands to draw from. And I suspect that, like, you know, it's probably a little bit of a chicken and an egg thing. There might be something where I read some folktale and I'm like, that's really interesting. It made me think about this. And then I start coming up with a story and I give it my own spin. Or it may be something like, you know, or it could also be, I want to think about, you know, what it would be like to live forever. Well, what do I have? Oh, vampires. That works, you know. So it strikes me that we're sort of, when we set out to build the world, we're sort of often taking from stuff that already exists and saying, well, I've got this rich history, you know, Buffy the Vampire Slayer being a perfect example, but I'm going to take the idea that they're vampires and then I'm going to, you know, spin it a little bit because I want to make, like, the Slayer, you know, this force of power. So we're going to develop that. So like you said, they had to actually really develop that mythology because that was their own unique thing. But at the same time, they could always go, well, let's do witches. Well, what do we know about witches? All right, and then pull what you want from it. And so it strikes me as being very interesting because, and where I'm going with this is that we're talking a lot about magic and worlds of fantasy right now, but the other way you can build worlds is to do sort of this speculation, which is, let's take the world as we know it, physics and laws as we know them, and then try to maybe either project forward and say, like, well, you know, we all use the internet right now. In 50 years, what's that going to look like? Or how is that going to change our society? And then you're still doing the same thing, but you're applying a different, you know, a different sort of rules to it, I guess. Or, you know, you're looking
you're
at
doing the exact same thing because science fiction and fantasy are the same.
Sorry. But my point is back in our genre shows, Kelly and I and a few of us, we all talked about, you know, the difference between fantasy and sci-fi. So for this one, we won't get into that argument again. I'm just going to say that for me, when I look at speculating a future world, I'm taking something that exists now and I'm trying to figure out, using the laws of physics as I know them. I'm not going to suddenly say everyone can fly. I'm going to say, no, but you could build a jetpack and you could do this, but I have to kind of at least know roughly. And there's a huge sliding scale on that, you know. But I think that's the general thrust of science fiction. And the other part of that speculation is, or you could go back in time and say, well, what if the Nazis won World War II? What does that do to everybody? But you're still kind of going up to that point in history saying, that's our world up till then. And then you're going, but what are the consequences of what events change there and what way does that shoot us off? And then what changes? But I'm not going to suddenly make it magic. I'm going to make it like, you know, knowing what I know about the real world and how technology might progress, where might we end up? And so I mean, these are all just different ways that you start building the world depending on which way you want to go.
It's like in the case of this month's Deceptionist book club pick, 50 Shades of Grey.
Oh, no.
Where, yes. Where the author said, what if I could take Twilight fanfic and make it more pervy?
Oh,
and
I have
spooky.
I have so many issues with that, but yeah, we should not.
That's its own show.
I think world building. I think one of the things that fanfiction actually does is it shortcuts your ability to build a world. So somebody else sets up the rule system for you, and then you, as a fanfiction or fan artist, can you build on that further. So it's kind of like it's like a Lego set where everything's half built for you, but you're still creating off of that. Like, for example, the squid in Harry Potter, and people will take little bits of things in fan fiction and give them their own world. That's actually probably the first world that I built. Was I got tired of doing that. I got tired of using other people's worlds, and I said, screw it, I'm just going to build my own. And so I just, like, it was a very obvious, I'm going to take this character and this setup and this scene. I mean, like, you could, it was like I bashed everything into big chunks and tried to smash them all together. But I think in fiction, I think that's why reading is so important to writing fiction, because really all you're doing is grinding up everything that you've ever read, ever seen, ever been exposed to, ever heard on the subway, or, you know, studied in history class. And when you create your story in your world, you're really just taking all of those pieces and rearranging them in your own way. And the finer the bits that you arrange, the more ownership, I guess, you have of the story.
Yeah, I wish you could convey this to everyone who has written Star Wars novels for the last 20 years.
Are you saying they're doing it wrong?
Only that they're terrible.
Okay. In that sense, they are doing it wrong. Well, I do. Right. I want to sort of segue into a question that has to do somewhat with reading. I do want to comment about what Kelly said. I think you're right that definitely, obviously, you can tell when people write things who have never read anything in the genre or just never read anything, period, because they will do stuff that they think it's actually amazing. Because I did teach creative writing at some point in my life, and you will get these people who come into class who just insist that they don't read. And I'm like, you're going to be terrible. And sometimes I'm sure there's occasionally a prodigy who doesn't need to know what anybody else has ever done in the history of the English language, but that's probably not you. I have been really glutting on, or gorging, I guess, on fantasy the last few months, because I was going to go to WISCON, which is a science fiction fantasy convention. So I really wanted to sort of be bone off on some stuff before then. And I think I got to a point last week where I was like, oh my God, everybody in the world has made up something better than I ever did. And then I had to like put it aside and read some nonfiction for a while. But so to kind of come at this from the other way, and I want to turn it around to our own creating in a minute, but I was just thinking, when you are experiencing somebody else's made-up world, whether it's a film, whether it's a book, or whatever, what are the first couple pieces of information that you're looking for? Like, what are the things that you feel like you need to know, and if you get half an hour into the movie and this hasn't been addressed, you're going to turn it off? Is there anything like that?
I'm sure there is. I just have to think about what it is.
Okay.
So, I mean, because I see that in two ways. I mean, I think in terms of character and set. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it doesn't necessarily need to be, again, this could be back to stuff that's, you know, purely realist. You know, you need mm-hmm. to know, you know, your character and whether you're in the most far-flung fantasy world or the furthest science fiction world, you're going to write characters. They're always going to be somehow – the point of writing a character is to somehow, you know, relate to humanity in some way. So we've got to understand, you know, who your character is and what they want. Or if they don't want anything, you know, why is that? And that's going to – you know, we know something's going to happen. You know, you can't go very long without something changing like that. And then I think we need to know – very quickly where they exist in this world, the relationships with other people. And so if you are doing a fantasy world, you're going to quickly need to know, you know, that's a really, really interesting question. I'm trying to think now. I mean,
maybe I should phrase it differently, actually, because I think what you're the first 30 minutes is not the way to do it. If you get to the end of the movie and there is something that hasn't come up, hasn't been shown, or hasn't been explained, you're going to be frustrated.
You're not talking about Prometheus, are you?
I was about to bring up Prometheus.
I could talk about Prometheus, but I could talk about Prometheus in fan fiction, but that's after the show. What are some things that, or is there anything that's completely essential that has to be in that fictional world, or it's a cop out, it's a cheat? You can use Prometheus as an example if you want.
Let me put it to
I
you
can
this
tell
way.
You...
you go first because I'm going to rant.
No, because you're going to say something quippy and then I will
no,
actually.
No, on the contrary.
All right, then go. Challenge.
Let's talk for a minute about the Cars movies by Pixar.
Okay, well, why do they have steering wheels?
My children are okay with the first movie, can't stand the second, and I'm right there with them because suspension of disbelief being what it is, the point is you enter a world where there are cars, they are drinking fossil fuels. What made the fossil fuels? Why are there spy cars that can walk on walls? Why are there restaurants where cars order food? Why is there a plane and the cars get inside the plane and there are chairs that the cars sit inside of? It tries – it's great for a four-year-old, but once you pass the age of about four and a half, you start to ask questions about this world and how did it come to be and why does it behave the way it does. And at least if you're me, it all falls apart and becomes unbearable, and you can't pay attention to what the characters are actually doing because all you can think is, why are their cars talking to one another and racing, and who drives them and what is going
Jim,
on?
I think you're the person who ruined Voltron for me forever because you said,
"How dare you?
Are you somebody I know said on a podcast, if the Voltron, big Voltron robot is so powerful and they always end up turning into that by the end of the fight, why don't they just start out as, so you're talking about logical questions that they, let me put it this way. Do you think that's an issue where if there's a logical question where if you answered it, the whole universe would fall apart? Do you think that that's just that they shouldn't have made that universe, or that they should take 30 seconds to address it, or which?
I don't think there's anything that the cars people could say, like, isn't it funny how we all talk and there are no human beings to drive us and we have doors? Like, there's no answer to that question.
There's no cut scene that could really just fix it all.
Okay.
Only no, it's a good, you know, we're vehicles with no drivers and we have agency. But those movies should not be.
That hits on something though. It's interesting to me because when we were talking a minute ago about when Kelly was saying, you know, you are always taking from what you've read or what you've seen in the world or whatever, you know, and so in the case of, as we're talking about supernatural stuff, you're taking myth and folklore and all this kind of stuff, and you're, you know, maybe grinding it up and making it something new, but it's still built on those foundations. And I was starting to think in that, I was like, well, there are examples, and I couldn't think of anything, where it's, you know, when I go back to my original commentary that I gave you guys last time and talking about looking at a surrealist exhibit, you know, there's no real precedent for melted clocks or anything like that. It's just that, but they just kind of use pure imagination to come up with something that, you know, made a statement in some way. And so I was thinking, what about fantasy that does not pull from fairies or vampires or an existing thing, but maybe I just want to tell a story that's a world where everyone has giraffe necks and that's it, you know, like, you know, so what am I doing there? And what am I, you know, I'm pulling something out, you know, I am basing it on, you know, well, there's, you know, giraffes and there's people, but I'm not pulling from a lot of these common tropes that you'd expect. And so it's interesting, and I am going to tie this to cars, but so I was thinking on that in, like, you know, what does it mean to make something like that? I mean, obviously you still have a story you want to tell. There's something interesting or else you wouldn't even bother with that. But there's something that you can tell about people with giraffe necks that, you know, is some point you want to get across about human nature, whatever it is. And so,
yeah, presumably you have something to say. Like, presumably you chose giraffes as opposed to hippos or rhinoceroses because
you had to stretch from reality to get to the to make an image, to make a point based on that image or something like that, right?
Right.
And so I've been thinking, it was with cars, it seems to me they maybe tried to do something like that. It's like, well, let's do a world that's, and there, you know, they could have done a story of a human story using fairies or this or that or something existing, but when you make it something like cars, it's a good visual. Kids get it, you know, we know what cars are, we know that stuff, but then you set yourself up because it's not using a folklore that exists in the past. Is it the equivalent of a fable of, like, talking animals? Is that the idea?
Or is it? Because I have never seen those movies, so I apologize.
I have not.
Good. No, don't apologize. You're lucky.
but okay, if that – is it an issue where if it was something that worked in a sort of relatively short kind of funny movie where they didn't, like – try to develop it. And it was when they started doing stuff like, oh yes, they go to petroleum bars, and you know, and you, if, when you, is it when you start adding too much? And that actually, this was the argument I know some people have made about Prometheus, is that the what's great about the alien movies is they don't ever try to tell you where the aliens come from, and then mm-hmm. people are like, okay, now they're telling us where the aliens come from, and we think it's stupid.
Right, that's the danger.
So it's like when do you? Right, it's a midichlorian problem. like when do you stop explaining?
I think there's definitely, especially with things with fairly whimsical constructs, there's a point where you have to stop looking, because you are gonna you're gonna start to see the seams, and you're gonna realize that it doesn't hold up. But the thing is, like, worlds where cars are real things don't hold up because they can't possibly exist anyway. I think with kids' entertainment, it's going to fall apart faster. I know that earlier, when Jim and I would watch a bunch of children's television because we had these very small children, there's a TV show called Word World.
Oh my lord.
on PBS, where, and it's, in terms of an education vehicle, it's really useful. They talk about, you know, how you can break words apart, and, you know, words, specific sounds go with specific letters, and you can do rhyming, and you can, you know, there's an episode where the ant character decides he's tired of being the smallest one, and so they get a G and an I, and suddenly he's a giant, and so he's this huge ant, and they have, but there's a point where with the show where you just look at it and you go, they have unlimited resources, because all they do is they just need letters. Where do they get the letters? Right. How do they, like, because, like, the tree will actually be the word, the letters T-R-E-E, sort of like shaped right. into a tree. And all you have to do to get rid of the tree is to pull the letters apart, and then suddenly you have a T, an R, and an E, and an E on the ground. And it's like, you could kill people all the time. Like, you just right. take the bug apart, suddenly the bug doesn't exist. Yes. You put the bug back
you
together,
yank,
the bug,
you
and it's
yank
just
his vowel out, and he's dead. Right.
Right. Or, and it's totally
so
cool.
You could say
nobody,
he's been
like,
disemboweled. Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh,
that's what he did. Yeah,
I find it fascinating.
It's a whole world made out
sequence.
Of letters. Like, yeah, they go, I need to bake a cake. I have an A, a K, and an E. Can anybody find me a C? Well, there's C in the crosswalk, and he just pulls the C out of the crosswalk and puts it in the egg, and everything's fine.
There's a whole like thing about, like, the Kabbalah and the name of God, right? And, like, how I mean, you could do, like, amazing, like, you know,
you are the first person to take it there. Congratulations.
I bet a Talmudic scholar made up that show. Sorry, we both talked at the same time. Go ahead.
Go for it.
No, I just said, I bet a Talmudic scholar made up that show, because it's completely roots in Judaism.
Save it for the Word World fan fiction forums.
So the thing about Word World, you know, you make jokes about it being Kabbalah scholars. The first creature that is made in the entire show is the dog, and then the dog is sort of responsible for everyone else getting made. And dog, of course, is backwards for God.
Wow.
So when we sit there and we stare at the show and we go cross-eyed because we're tired of watching it with our children who won't watch anything else, you start to, you know, give it really great, whimsical, crazy backstories.
Man, when you are watching enough children's television, you are desperate for subtext.
is that where that whole Teletubby thing came from?
Hails yes. I assume Jerry Falwell had a 3-year-old somewhere on the premises.
We're watching Thomas in our house right now, and it's really sort of fascinating that the lessons from the English show and how they're very different than the lessons that you learn from American television.
That's funny. Now, I have a couple friends who are European, and they're addicted to that show on behalf of their child, I think.
There's a lot of, like, learn your place, and the most important thing is to be very useful. System.
It's like Downton Abbey, the younger generation.
It really is. It's fascinating.
Okay. Go ahead.
So back to world building.
But
after we've had all of these.
The dinosaur.
What about that? Okay, so we
stop it.
We got to word world because what?
Because if you look too closely at worlds, they break apart, much right. like the word people or word animals in Word World. Yeah, so we should probably get to the point.
So I guess the final thing that I came up with is just since we didn't really have an answer for necessarily a specific thing that we're looking for as readers when it comes to world building. And I have just a suggestion. Do you need to just start with what it is that makes the story unique? So, and I like, is that kind of the hook that gets you in there and then you build around that?
That sounds more like a marketing strategy than writing a story. Which I'm not saying isn't true, because I definitely, like, when I want to build a world, I want to make sure that it's not a direct copy of someone else's. So I do want to try to force something, at least in a slightly different combination than everyone else. I know that when I'm watching a story, if there's something in it that doesn't sit right, if there's some sort of paradox or, I don't know, if the bullshit detector goes off at some point and they don't fix it soon, I will be distracted until they do. And if they don't fix it ever, then I'm just like, well, that was a really lame story.
And if it's a good story, it's about what you're trying to say with what you've chosen. Like, if you are choosing a story where Hitler won World War II, I would imagine you're trying to say something about the world where that didn't happen by presenting a contrast. Or, you know, if you're trying to present a world where I'm trying to remember the name of that John Travolta movie when I was in college where white people
Earth.
No, I wish. Where
Look
there
Who's
was a,
Talking
there was a,
To.
There was a movie where white people I think it was called White Man's Burden. Where
oh my god!
Where the white people were treated like black people, and the black people were treated like white people.
Oh my god!
Like if you're doing that, you're trying to say if you're showing what isn't, you're trying to say something about what is. If that makes sense.
No, it does.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it comes back down to what drew us to it in the first place, which kind of goes back to the why question. You know, we're starting with, you know, in my case, I wanted to start with this detective, and I wanted to use a supernatural element because it just intrigued me that would be the thing because, and maybe I'm getting a little personal here, but like maybe if I were to really think about it, I don't know if this is true or not, but, you know, I'm a pretty skeptical person. I'm not really a believer. And so to me, maybe the weirdest thing that could happen to me is to be faced with that, you know, completely, it's, you know, evident truth that there is something out there or whatever. And so, you know, then something like The Exorcist would be super scary, right? So to me, maybe that was a way of sort of, that's why I would take interest in that. And so then I start exploring the world from there and start building up the rules and this and that of the world. Like, okay, now I'm accepting that as being true for this character. So it's going to shatter him, but he's going to start looking at the world differently. And I've got to sort of build the world up as he's looking around. Does that make sense?
I think there's something to that. I mean, just in general, a lot of the supernatural fiction that you'll see is taking the things that maybe the author subconsciously is worried about or not subconsciously thinks are ridiculous and taking them seriously and following them out to their logical conclusion. A lot of it is people working through their own stuff, for lack of a better term. No, which is not to say that you're an emotional basket case, although...
but I am.
a case could be made. But I mean, you know, all fiction is really just the writer's way of working things out. And, you know, sometimes it takes the form of Catch-22 or Catcher in the Rye, and sometimes it takes the form of a goblin on your shoulder telling you to kill, kill, kill.
Of you guys, and I think, Kelly, you're definitely more comfortable with this than me, but like what I notice is I can't think of very many examples where, well, not since I was a kid really, where I felt very comfortable just writing purely, building a world that is purely fantasy. I feel like but these things really interest me, but at the same time, there's a couple things. I'll take what I did with Wormwood, which is this sort of urban fantasy idea, which is it's our world, but then we're going to take this stuff and add it to it, you know, and like I said, there's sort of a shortcut for that because you can just say, okay, vampires are real. I'll go with the basic rules of vampires. Maybe I'll tweak this or that, and then you're up and running. It's like a pre-made kit a little bit, right? Then there's another one that we haven't touched on yet, and I think we'll probably circle back to this, but it's something that I want to probably spend more time talking about, which is the idea of a hidden world or a dual world, which is we start with our world, but we go into a fantasy world. This is Narnia or Wonderland or Neverland or Oz. I mean, this is a rich tradition of this, right? And this is interesting to me as a world builder because you can start with Kansas and then you can inject your character, you, into this strange world, and they're discovering it as the reader is discovering it. And so you have this chance to sort of build the sets as you're going. Not that you don't have to think about it first. I'm just saying that, like, as the character and the reader are seeing it all for the first time. And I think that's a really interesting technique. But I guess what I've noticed is that when I start to think, like, okay, I'm going to set something up in a totally alien world, like a totally fantasy world, it's Middle Earth or whatever, I guess for me, I have a harder time with that, maybe because I'm not sure what story I want to tell. I'm not sure why I want to tell it in that world. I'm fascinated by the guy getting stuck in that world because that gives me a character thing. But I guess, you know, like, I guess maybe, and this is maybe just my inclination, and you guys can chime in on your feelings on it, but maybe my inclination is that I'm not as quickly ready to find a character that I can, or I can't set up the environment where I can relate to the character as much in a pure fantasy world, whether it's magical or, you know, everyone has giraffe necks or whatever, you know?
When you come across them in stories, do you relate to them?
Yes. Well, I in pure fantasy stories, like in epic fantasy stories, so I loved like The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings as a kid and stuff like that. I loved those. But I think when I see them now, I see that it's this basic hero's quest kind of thing, and I get it and I like it. But I don't. So as a counterexample, so I tried to read a bunch of fantasy not too long ago, and I read some good stuff. And I was reading the Kelly, on your recommendation, I think it was the Robert Jordan, the Eye of the World. Was that the first one?
Yeah.
And it was really interesting. I like it, but what I noticed as I went along is that there's so many tropes that draw from, you know, all these other things. I felt like it was kind of like very Middle Earth, but by way of Dune somehow, you know. There was this weird like mix of things, and I could see the influences he was drawing from, but the story still seemed to be so mirroring what I remember of like the Lord of the Rings stuff or The Hobbit, you know, of like, oh, you know, these evil things are attacking the village, now we must go, and now these other strangers are going to help us and we're going to ride off, you know. And there's a lot of that, and it keeps going and going and going, and I felt my interest waning slightly as it went along. It's not poorly written. It's just that I guess I found myself going like, yeah, I know this story. I see how this goes, and sort of being intrigued by it. But then I found myself more riveted by something like Game of Thrones on, you know, because that was different. That was now all about the politics of everyone playing these games, if that makes sense.
But not nearly enough giraffe necks.
Right. No,
I think jump back to what I said at the start of this section, because I said start with what makes the world unique, and then Kelly said that that's more of a marketing consideration, and I think that because I think unique is probably not the right thing, because you know that's you're not necessarily going to find that. So I guess start with what makes this a world for you that you can tell a unique story in. Like, in other words, if you're making a new world, it's to do something that you couldn't do writing a story that's based on yourself and your friends from college. And I think the dual world that Dave was talking about, I mean, that definitely has to go into the idea of, I think if you're doing that story, you have to be very explicitly saying something about the modern world. Lewis was obviously interested in, you know, England around World War II when he was writing Narnia. And I mean, that's why that's where they're going back and forth from. But then on the other hand, you know, Tolkien was obviously really interested in the same sort of view of England in the war. And he kept his whole thing happening in Middle Earth. So there's definitely, and what you're saying about high fantasy, I think that that's a good point, that I'm sure if I was better versed in it, there are people who do not do this,
right.
But it's not as if most of those books are starting out from a completely creative, invented, made-up world. They're starting from essentially Tolkien or two or three other possible. And Martin, to some extent, started from his actual view of the history of England when he was writing Game of Thrones. So
right.
and you definitely see other fantasy stories in there, but I think he was kind of basically taking the framework of the War of the Roses, I think. Mm-hmm. And sort of then,
well,
then
and
just
even if you look at the map of his world, like, mm-hmm. it's England.
Right. Yeah, I mean that's
really, you know, you got the cold Scots in the north and mm-hmm. yeah, you've got a narrow sea and you've got a bunch of crazy
Europe
people.
Over with those people.
Great.
Yeah.
It just happens to be a
has
desert
Europe
because
Asia
that's convenient. Yeah.
Okay. Right. Sorry.
But I think one of the reasons why he didn't just say, okay, fine, we're going to set it in England and, you know, we'll use the mm-hmm. geography that we'll directly, explicitly use the geography everyone's comfortable with mm-hmm. is because I think that might have been too limiting for him. He wanted to have all of these completely, he wanted to have all the cultures in a very small area. And you can't really do that if you stick with history. So we couldn't just sort of slightly tweak what we had. He had to go someplace brand new.
Right.
You know, if you look at something like Star Wars, it's like they needed to hop planets to get these completely different cultures and to get this giant scale. So it wasn't enough to have a land with a swamp next to a land with a desert next to a land with whatever you'd call the Death Star. Like, mm-hmm. You know, it wanted to be epicer than that. So they made it, they had to make their own world to make it that epic.
And, you know, it's interesting because I think that's even a rule or that's a piece of advice that I've heard just in creative writing workshops, even if you're just working in realist fiction. It's like, you know, maybe you're writing something that's like a memoir, but I've heard, you know, I've heard people say, you know, like, I remember when I was in school, you know, a memoir writer, you know, coming to, you know, speak with the class and everything and just talking about like, well, you know, and reading a scene and going like, well, I don't really remember if this was exactly like that, but the spirit of it is true. So I just sort of built this memory and kind of, you know, I don't know that they were terracotta pots or something like that, but but I don't remember, but I'm going to put them in there because it, you know, I needed to build the world and make it, you know, real and strong so that you could get the same feeling I got, but I didn't necessarily use the exact reality. So I think there's that, I think you're absolutely right on in that, you know, that works on all scales. It could be from like not getting a memory right or not letting reality get in the way of a good truth. If you have a good story that diverges from your own reality very slightly, to, you know, I didn't go there, but what if I did, to, you know, I didn't go there, but what if I had a jetpack and could fly, you know, or, you know, so I think that's very fascinating and a great point that, you know, I think there's a scale where you just you're diverging from reality, but keeping in the physical laws of the universe too. You're going like, well, you know what? I could do more with my story if this person had dragons, you know, which I think is really fascinating.
Of course, the real difference between history and Game of Thrones is that in history, something happened.
Okay. And on that note, we've been talking a lot about world building in theory, in sort of very much an abstract, maybe talking about other people's world building and fan fiction that we would write about giraffe neck people who were made out of words. But Kelly had come up with an idea going forward to help us be a little bit more concrete in what we're talking about and to kind of build this as a more craft-oriented discussion and less of a theory-oriented discussion. So Kelly, do you want to take it from
there? So what we wanted to do with this series, for you, the audience, is to discuss specific elements of world building. So it's things like we'd be talking about culture and geography and if there is some sort of new physics or magical system, like what you have to do to actually build those sorts of elements in your story. So in order to again, like Carolyn says, go from some sort of theoretical, well, this might be cool, this might be fun. We want to actually do it for you guys and then have a discussion about that. And you are, just like our genre shows, you are more than welcome to play along at home. We would love to hear from you guys and we can assign you a random, I don't know what we call these things. I guess world building strategy.
Yeah.
Based on the four that we came up with. We spent an entire episode's worth of emails determining what these four would be. And as a disclaimer, we don't want to imply that these are the four, that they don't have, they all have many things in common. They all have things that are unique to them. Most examples we would use have elements of all of them. In fact, I think we identified a few things that do every single one of them, like Doctor Who. But so these are the four we came up with for the purposes of our discussion. So what we are going to do to wrap this podcast up is I'll tell you what they are. But then we are going to randomly assign one of us to each one of these so that in future podcasts, I believe the next one we're going to do is just the basic where specifically do you begin with this type of world. So each one of us will talk about this specific, based on this world that we're creating for this series. Right. We're not necessarily going to write novels at the end of this, but the idea is that it's a big enough world that it could hold a novel, so to speak. It's not a short story world. It's a,
right.
You have to figure all this out because you're going to be spending a lot of time as a writer in this place.
Right. So we're each going to take one of these so that we all have something to talk about rather than just spouting theories that we can be like, man, I'm trying to write a story set in the future and I'm stuck because I forgot to do this or that. So we'll have very practical things and we'll all have different sort of experiences, which I think is really fascinating. So yeah, this is going to be interesting.
It's going to be cool. So the four types of world structures that we've come up with are, the first one is to build a world based on our own, but X years in the future, and X needs to be bigger than like 5. The second is to build a world based on folklore, mythology, supernatural, but that is not our own world. And I want to amend that slightly to say that could also be a sci-fi thing, but not a take our world into the future as much as it's Star Wars.
Yes, and Kelly and I disagree about that.
What? Yeah. Okay. So the third one is to build a world where 2012 is very different because of something that happened in the past. So that would be the speculative sort of what if Hitler won, what if the atom bomb didn't work or whatever you want to do. And then the fourth one is to build a world just like ours, except for some supernatural sci-fi element that makes it different. So that is urban fantasy, but we don't want to call it urban fantasy.
Right. We didn't want to use the sort of marketing term, but we realized that that is a very common term. And it is a lot of what we're, what is typed as urban fantasy is a lot of what we're talking about. So that's, your world with vampires, your world with demons, it could be your world with elves in it, or even superheroes actually falls into that. It's basically our world, but, a guy gets bit by a radioactive spider and he gets powers. And so it falls into that category as well.
Yeah, what if DVRs gain sentience? What then?
Right.
Wasn't that the idea of TiVo?
I think so.
So those are our four worlds. We're hoping at some point one of us picks some sort of dual thing so that we could talk about that, because that's kind of its own beast, but not its own beast, but its own beast.
Just to quickly say that is any one of us using any of these prompts could actually write some kind of dual world. I mean, it's unlikely with the urban fantasy one, but you could have a person from 2012 that ends up in the future, and that could be your way of describing that future world. Or you could have somebody go into the fantasy world or go into the alternate history. So it's a technique we might use, and we'll definitely be talking about the dual worlds. I'd be surprised if one of us didn't use this, as a way of helping us build our world. So, that'll be interesting, but that is why we didn't have it be its own prompt, as I recall.
Yep. All right. So I'm going to roll the random.org random sequence generator. I've assigned us all a number, based on our order in the alphabet by first name. And here we go.
What do you know? I got the one nobody wanted.
Okay, so crap. I want to re-roll. So the person who gets to build a world based on our own but X years in the future is me. I don't want to write future, but that's fine.
But it's just the same, Kelly.
Go ahead.
We can have it next time, next week, next month.
Never mind. All right, we can talk about that later.
No one would know if you lied.
I know. Well, I'm not going to lie. That's why.
You write fiction. Shut it up.
Okay, the rest of us are in suspense.
Okay, so number two, build a world based on folklore, mythology, supernatural, but that is not our own, went to person number two, which is Dave.
Okay, all right.
Number three, build a world where 2012 is very different because of something that happened in the past, goes to person number three, which is Jim.
Oh, okay. The heavy research one.
Which right. means that Caroline gets to build a world just like ours, except for some supernatural sci-fi element that makes it different.
Ooh, okay.
So
there... Jim, keep it easy for yourself. Just dinosaurs didn't die out. Just right. That's just...
Okay, look, if that's your excuse for dinosaurs, that's awesome.
We use raptors for taxicabs.
Yeah.
Man.
Okay, what so if this is going to be
all
very
the cars
interesting.
Sentient, killed us all off and then lived.
Yeah. What you're going to do right. is come up with an explanation for cars.
Oh my gosh. It's
only
my
cars.
Dream come
at
true.
The end of the movie, they find a human graveyard. And
oh my God, that's horrible.
So... You blew it up. Damn you.
Oh my God. All right. So we will convene again in about a month and talk about what kind of, and I guess I for the next month, we're just going to talk about like the sort of really basics of how we would start developing this world. And, you know, Kelly's going to come to us with a complete novel, but
yeah,
that's not an assignment.
We mentioned this, you know, in our conversations, but we should say it that these may not even be stories. I mean, it really could mm-hmm. be like paragraphs of backstory that we came up uh-huh. with. And we kind of joked about like, I don't know how this fits, but I know that there's wastelands to the north of the village now, because, you know, like, right. we don't know what this is going to take. It may be a story. It's probably all going to depend on how we write and how we world build, really. I mean, mm-hmm. just how we approach this. So how we find our way into this world. So should be very, very interesting.
And that's exactly the point. And so for this first one, it's not going to be my whole world is built, here it is, as much as in order to come up with the story that I'm creating in my head, here are the things that I had to nail down. And here's what was hard about it. Here's what I decided I really don't care about until I get 3/4 of the way through it mm-hmm. and whatever. I think that's going to be, my expectation is that that's going to be fairly different for everyone.
Excellent.
I hope,
yeah.
I hope
all
we have
right.
a good time in a month.
And should we also say that if people want us to assign them one, that they should email us and maybe Kelly will use her random generator? And
I will, yes. I will return to random.org and generate them.
Yeah.
Or, this is or like the best part of Kelly's day.
I'll just assign you the hardest one.
Exactly.
Whatever mode you're in, depending on how much money you bribe them with. Yeah.
That's right.
So you can either pick one of those, as we stated it, or email us or tweet us, and we'll give you that information in a minute, and then we will assign something to you, and you can play along with us.
Well, you know, yes. I bet that everybody is going to think that a different one of those is the hardest one, would be my bet, because those are all things that you see in various genres, and I bet obviously
right.
some people would rather write one of those, and some people would not like to write one of those in a million years.
Well, I was so, just complaining, saying I have a harder time, you know, with something that's a completely separate world of fantasy, like uh-huh. how to start with that. And that's what I got. So,
and I do not like sci-fi, and I have to build it with yeah. incomplete reality. And
but I think we can all agree that Jim's is the worst.
Yes. Well.
Well, but he has the cars idea already.
I would say that no matter what I got. So.
And now I'm sure Sigrid is listening to this at some point, and will be screaming at us right now and going, "What do you mean that's the hardest one? That is the one that I
Sigrid would love
time.
That one.
Just oh, yeah. wrote a novel about the cotton gin."
Well, of course, cotton gin is very important. All right.
I
so
already know that the title of my story is something something steampunk. So just be ready for that.
Well, naturally. All right.
What if it was never electricity?
Indeed. All right. So does anybody want to talk about something that they're working on now, which I would just say I'm not working on anything now, so I will
No, you're working on building a story of a world that is just like ours, except for some supernatural sci-fi element.
Right. Until today, until just now, I was not, but now I am. Anybody else have something they're working on or something they want to plug?
Well, I can plug my book, Sparrow and Crow. The first issue of that comes out July 25th in comic shops, in finer comic shops.
We'll digitally, right?
And actually, the first issue will be out digitally a month later. We ended up having to go, it's a bi-monthly schedule. So what we decided to do is So July will be the release of the print copy, and then August will be the release of the digital copy. And then I do, and I can't remember if I said this on the last show or not, so you guys can tell me if I'm repeating myself, but what I have learned recently is that because our book in print would not come out in the month of October, I was really kind of bummed because Halloween is a perfect time for us to, you know, plug Sparrow and Crow. And so I got the publisher to tentatively agree. We have to come up with the content, and we've been developing it, but to do a digital-only Halloween anthology special. And so we have four stories. I wrote one. My co-creator, Jeremy Rogers, wrote one. And then another one is actually by Paul Montgomery. And we've got artists. Yeah. And I just got his script today, and it's really great. It's a really great Sparrow and Crow story. So these are going to be like 4 8-page stories. And we're hoping to just release it digitally only in and around Halloween. So that's a fun one.
Sounds really cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm excited about that. Love it.
Right. Anybody else want to plug anything? Last chance?
If anybody wants to catch up with what I'm doing, they can join me at the Barnes & Noble Cafe, where I will be reading the 2 months' worth of books that I have let stack up.
I
hope to have those done by August 23rd. And if they'd like to hear me pontificate about what I think about them, they are welcome to join me. I'll have an extra chair at the table.
Excellent. All right. Well, do we want to talk about where we can be contacted on the internet? Dave.
Okay. Well, if you want to tweet us, you would tweet us at @deceptionists. And that's a great place to go and just kind of let us know what you thought of the show or ask us questions. If you have questions that you want us to answer as we start the next show, maybe something from this show that we didn't cover, that's a great place to do it. We've taken a lot of questions from Twitter over the past, and so that's a really good one.
All right. Kelly, is there an email address to which someone could write if they wanted you to randomly assign them a number?
The email address is contact@thedeceptionists.org.
Thank you. And do we have a website, Jim?
We do. I want to say that it's thedeceptionist.org.
I believe you've got all of those correct. Ah. All right. Well, I believe that that about does it for us now. Are we ready to sign off? Do we want to do our Twitters? our Twitters? I am at Mad Marvel Girl on Twitter.
And I'm at Dacampo, D-A-C-C-A-M-P-O.
And I am at Anna Luna.
And I am Jimsky.
So you should totally
what
tweet
topsy-turvy world have we entered?
Crazy. All right.
But the men are women and the women are men.
Well, by the way, I've been looking on the internet. According to Netflix, White Man's Burden, starring John Travolta and Harry Belafonte, came out.
I knew it was Harry Belafonte.
It is not available on DVD. I cannot imagine why.
Nor can I.
All right. And with that, I believe we can say goodnight.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
He has no dog. He has no friends. And his lawn is dying. What about all those packages he sends? What's he building in there? That hook light on the stairs. What's he building in there?
Exactly. And Kelly has something to explain to me about Harry Potter and Squid, but I think that's for after the show.
Oh, I disagree. Everyone needs to know about.
I'm sorry. Is there like a squid that lives in the lake? Is that in the books?
I don't know. I think so.
Is that like a kraken? Okay, so that would at least be a reason for people to be really interested in Harry Potter and Squid.
I believe, because I know that a lot of the people in the Harry Potter fan fiction community have like pored over every inch of these books. But from what I've gleaned. I believe that yes, in the lake where the Goblet of Fire challenge was, there is a kraken. Like, doesn't he fight one?
Well, that
save everyone's friends.
That explains.
Are you guys talking about some sort of wizard sex kraken?
Yeah, I think
no.
There's a
well,
once Harry Potter
edits this part out, we should talk about it later.
Yes, I think this goes after the credits. Okay, so
we absolutely should not edit this part out. It is crucial to our understanding of the subject matter.
I'm just letting y'all talk. I don't even know what we're talking about.
So